You're listening to live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board hearings into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. Lee Dickinson has just adjourned for about 10 minutes and then going to come right back. He's got a long list of witnesses yet to go. Two more people, one of whom is the Coast Guard investigator who was first on board the Exxon Valdez, and the other, a Melissa Allen, who was added at the last minute. She's from the U.S. Department of Transportation. She may be here to talk about drug testing. We're not really sure. The person that we just heard from is Michael Peet. He runs a laboratory and devised drug testing protocols, and he talked about what it meant that Joe Hazelwood, even 11 hours after the incident, was tested and showed a 0.01% blood alcohol content. He said if you extrapolate that back, he could have been quite drunk at the time of the incident. Assuming he didn't take in any more alcohol, he could have been at about 2.2, which is far too drunk to operate an automobile, about twice as drunk as the legal standard. I'm Steve Heimel, and with me is Bruce Melzer. And Bruce, I guess we might as well send it back to the studio here and stand by.
I think we should. We ought to say that KSK will be carrying these hearings in their entirety tonight. And as soon as they're over, KSK will go to All Things Considered and Alaska News Nightly. We are taking from now, it'll probably be about a seven-minute break. We'll be back with you in just a few moments. It appears that Chairman Lee Dickinson is determined to plow through the list of people, the two people left to testify. We expect it's going to be a long evening. So this is coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board, KSKA Anchorage, and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Good evening and welcome back to the live coverage from KSKA Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network of the National Transportation Safety Board investigation into the grounding of the Exxon Valdez. I'm Steve Heimel. I'm here with Bruce Melzer of KSKA. We are awaiting the return of the investigatory panel to quiz a new witness. We've just finished hearing from a toxicologist who talked about the blood alcohol test on Captain Joseph Hazelwood. It was taken about 11 hours after the Exxon Valdez went aground. Previous to that, we heard from a couple of Coast Guard people who were on duty the night of the crash, who talked about what they could and could not see on the radar and how their practices had changed since the incident. We got similar testimony to that from the pilot, who said that the pilots had also made quite a few changes. But basically, there's another person on duty in that room now. There are now three people on duty in any watch, and they plot where the vessels are, which is something they weren't doing before once they got past Valdez Narrows.
Let's just set the scene for a moment. We've got a probably about 60 spectators. We've got a large press pool. Between the press pool and the technical experts provided by the National Transportation Safety Board, and then there are four parties, Exxon, Coast Guard, the state, and Alyeska. Each one of those parties is allowed to answer questions, allowed to ask questions. They each have panels of experts with them. Between the journalists and the various panels, we have probably about 100 people up front. They outweigh the number of spectators between the press and the panelists. They outweigh the number of spectators, I'd say probably by about a third.
The crowd did pick up a little bit today.
Yeah.
And, there are more kind of people who just seem to be interested and come in from time to time to actually look at it firsthand, maybe drawn by what they heard on the radio or saw on television or even saw on CNN. We have quite a few out-of-town media here. The way that witnesses are questioned is different with this type of proceeding than most anything else. The people who did the investigating in the first place are the ones that get to ask the first questions. And essentially what they do is they sort of recreate the evidence that they gathered for the audience that's watching the public hearing. So we are now awaiting the next witness. There were two witnesses left to go today. One is Melissa Allen of the U.S. Department of Transportation. We don't really know what she's here for. She was brought in at the last minute.
The witness list has now climbed to, well, it started out at 28 people at the beginning of the hearing. Originally, when they scheduled this hearing, they were saying around 20 witnesses. By the time we actually got rolling, was 28, and this next witness, Melissa Allen, was the 28th to be added. She'll be questioned by members of the NTSB and their technical panels. The other interesting thing about this hearing is that each one of the parties gets a chance to answer questions. Gets a chance to ask questions. And so we get this sort of funny round robin where it'll go to the NTSB panel, it'll then go to the various parties, and then go back to people from the NTSB. So the questioning takes a long round and sometimes gets pretty circuitous.
The members themselves usually tend to try and fill in little gaps in the records, little things that might not have been understood. And that's how you know they're finishing up. Now, Lee Dickinson is about to call it back to order and call the next witness.
Thank you, Ms. Allen, for, sorry for the delay. Mr. Colucciello, will you swear in and qualify the next witness, Ms. Melissa Allen, please?
Do you swear that the testimony you are about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Please be seated. Please state your full name.
My name is Melissa Jane Allen.
And who is your employer?
I'm employed by the Department of Transportation, the Office of the Secretary.
And what is your position and responsibility with the office?
I am the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Administration. In that position, my responsibilities cover the full range of deputy to the Assistant Secretary for personnel practices, financial management, information systems, facilities, et cetera, for the Department of Transportation.
Thank you. Mr. Berkey now will ask you some additional questions.
Ms. Allen, would you refer to Exhibit 11B as in boy, and the attached exhibit, which I believe is 11B-1, which is a supplementary?
Yes, sir.
Do you have that document?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Could you tell us where the supplement was taken from, or the addition addendum to that 11B that's designated as 11B-1?
Yes. The supplement is from a departmental drug testing guide, which was issued July 1, 1988,
okay,
implementing this order.
Now, who prepared this policy?
The order, the drug-free departmental workplace, was prepared under my direction, under the direction of the then Secretary of Transportation, Elizabeth Dole, by a team of individuals working for me and what we refer to as our modal or operating administrations, people from the Federal Aviation Administration, Coast Guard, et cetera.
And when I refer to you, I'm going to refer to DOT, if you will. We'll just translate that as your position within DOT. DOT consult with other people regarding the development of this document in terms of drug testing?
Yes, sir, we did. The order, which was developed in June of 87, we worked both with the Department of Health and Human Services, which was at the same time we were developing this order, developing its guidelines, which we frequently refer to as drug testing guidelines. The Department of Justice, other individuals around Washington who were considered experts in drug testing programs, we hired consultants, and we also discussed drug testing programs with entities such as the board itself, or members of the, not members of the board, but staff from the NTSB board.
Did you follow any of the NTSB recommendations or suggestions as to what should be done in that document in terms of drug testing of DOT employees?
We were under guidance of an executive order which came out in September 1986, which specified how we were to develop a program. We were limited by that executive order in developing this program to urine testing. There were supplemental guidance issued by the Office of Personnel Management, which is the personnel arm of the executive branch of the government, which specified what types of testing implementing the executive order, and we followed those guidelines. So a long-winded answer to your question is, to the extent that NTSB recommended anything beyond the guidance that we got from either the executive order or OPM or the Justice Department, we did not follow the NTSB guidelines or recommendations.
Does that mean you, let me see if I can clarify that. Does that mean that the guidelines you followed was strictly in terms of what specimen are to be collected and what drugs are to be measured was based strictly on the Department of Health and Human Services guidelines on drug testing?
The specimen to be collected, I believe, is based in the executive order itself. The executive order talks about a drug-free workplace and talks about drug testing of urine. The specific drugs identified were illegal drugs or drugs which are registered in the substance categories of 1 through 5, so they did not include alcohol. And then the specific procedures for the testing, i.e. cutoff levels, chain of custody, what type of a laboratory one could use, et cetera, were developed from the HHS guidelines.
Now, let's talk strictly now at the moment about post-accident testing, because that's one we say NTSB is concerned about. And that's one we're concerned about, I think, in the environment we're here today to talk about. Now, do you use the urine specimen and those 5 drugs, exclusive of alcohol, as the media and the drugs that you test for in post-accident testing?
The post-accident testing that we do is a component of our comprehensive program. It is limited by the guidance I referred to earlier, i.e. the executive order and then the OPM, Office of Personnel Management guidance, that we can only test for illegal drugs and that we can only test urine. So, yes, the post-accident testing policy that we have is part of a policy designed both as a deterrent to drug use in the workplace and as a means of identifying individuals who use illegal drugs. It is not meant as part of a post-accident investigation in the sense that the board does an investigation.
Well, I'm going to come back to that issue a little bit later, but let me ask you now again from a post-accident point of view, who does this policy cover?
The policy would cover all civilian employees, i.e. civil servants who are employed by the Department of Transportation. It most specifically applies to people that we refer to as safety-sensitive people, who in Exhibit 11B are shown in attachment, Exhibit A to that, Appendix A to that, which is a 4 or 5 page appendix towards the back. I believe you referred to it earlier when you were pointing out the civil service series of a VTS watch stander.
Okay. So, and as you point out, that would cover then the watch standard and controllers in the aviation industry and that sort of thing.
Yes, that is correct.
And can you tell me how it was decided whether an individual will or will not be tested under and how that decision is made and by whom?
All right. The way we developed the procedure was based on a sort of a 3-tier decision process. First of all, there must be a qualifying incident or accident. And the qualifications of a transportation incident or accident have to do with death, serious injury, or substantial property damage. They do not include incidents such as in the airline area, near mid-airs or anything like that. So there's a determination made by, I believe in the implementing guidelines, we refer to it as an OA, an operating administration, or a mode. In other words, the Coast Guard is responsible for making that determination. It does not come to the Office of the Secretary. Having made the determination that there is a qualifying accident, the next sort, essentially, is were there any individuals whose performance at or about the time of the accident may have contributed to the accident? And then the final sort is can the determination be made to eliminate any of those individuals from testing because you are sure that their performance did not contribute to the accident?
So in this particular accident, that is the grounding of the Exxon Valdez, and referring now to the vessel control individuals, who made that, who according to this policy would make that decision to test or not to test?
The way that decision is being made in, I believe, all of the modal administrations, it is being made at a district or regional level. So in the instance of the Coast Guard, I may have your district offices wrong, but it's in Alameda, California. The decision was made that we have both a qualifying accident, that there were individuals whose performance at or about the time of the accident may have contributed, and that there's no way to exclude them. Therefore, the decision was made at Alameda to order a post-accident test.
Okay. Now, if you refer to page Roman numeral page 6-2 of that attachment document, paragraph 5 on in that document, 11B-1, I believe it is. I believe that decision is supposed to be made within 8 hours. Is that correct?
The decision for, yes, that's what the word said. The decision for scheduling the urine collection must be begun within 8 hours of receipt of notice. And I think that's important, that an accident qualifies.
So can you explain to me what happened in this particular accident that we had individuals sampled approximately, according to my calculation, something like 90 hours after the accident?
I can give you a chronology as I've been able to reconstruct it. Obviously, there were a lot of things happening. At some point on Friday, I believe early afternoon, but I'm not certain of an exact time, Alameda, Coast Guard Alameda, was notified that there had been a qualifying accident under our post-accident testing policy. The way the procedures are implemented, that's the beginning of the 8-hour clock, the point at which someone needs to make the decision.
What time was that?
I don't know the exact time. I am told that it was sometime in the early afternoon on Friday.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
Continue.
Ms. Allen, excuse me, what date?
Friday.
Friday the 24th.
Thank you.
Okay, so sometime early afternoon on Friday the 24th. I'm sorry. Let me back off. At some time on early afternoon on Friday the 24th, Coast Guard management made the decision to order the test in Alameda. In other words, they decided that we needed to have a test, that we've gone through those three decision levels.
And that decision is what triggers the 8 hours? Is that what you're saying?
No, I was looking at my chronology wrong. They actually made the decision early on Friday afternoon to order the test. So the accident occurred in the first hour of the day. The decision was made beyond our guidelines to order the test, but the decision was made sometime in the early afternoon. And
okay, then go on. What happened then at that stage?
Coast Guard Alameda was aware of a decision that was being made to test the one watchstander who was on duty, Mr. Blandford, the test that was referred to earlier, the sample that was taken that afternoon. There was some discussion at Alameda about whether that qualified under our drug testing program. And later on Friday, I'm told by 1500 hours, they decided that no, that was not under the DOT procedures, and therefore they wanted to proceed with the DOT testing. They being a person we refer to as a drug program coordinator, who is a Coast Guard civilian employee employed at Alameda, contacted Upjohn Healthcare Services Incorporated to request that a collector be sent to Valdez to conduct a collection. Upjohn Healthcare has, under our contractual arrangements with them, 24 hours to get the collector to the site. They are dependent on commercial transportation. They're dependent on getting to remote sites, and we have given them this guidance within the contract. It's my understanding that the contractor, the individual collector, selected for this collection because he was available and because he's one of their better collectors, came from Atlanta rather than from the West Coast. And he flew to Seattle, Washington, then flew on to Anchorage, arriving in Anchorage on Sunday, March 26th at 1400. He was delayed en route by flight problems. So, although he may have left Atlanta on time, his flight problems en route to Anchorage delayed him. And I'm not certain what happened at this stage of the game. He either missed his connection to Valdez or was unable to make a connection to Valdez and therefore rented a car and drove to Valdez. It's my understanding that he arrived, my time that I have in my notes is around 20:30 on Sunday afternoon, March 26, and contacted someone in charge, I don't know who at that point, because there's no local drug program coordinator to talk to, and began his collection procedure.
Do you, DOT, consider that arrangement a satisfactory one to do post-accident testing on individuals that are involved as safety issues?
No, we do not, and we have been working both with Coast Guard and the Federal Aviation Administration, the only two administrations that we've done post-accident testing in so far, to figure out another way to comply fully with the HHS guidelines and still be able to collect a sample. Upjohn Healthcare has certainly done a very good job for us in our routine testing. We had decided at the very beginning not to depend on our own civilian employees to collect from other civilian employees. We are rethinking that in the sense that we may want to use some of the medical people that are on hand or closer to a vicinity than, say, Upjohn might be. We need to use the collection chain of custody, which is required under the executive order and the HHS guidelines. We can't use something that a local police department uses in this instance. We must use our own chain of custody form. We have to use a collection kit that fits the HHS guidelines, and we need to figure out the logistics of how to get those kits and chain of custody forms dispersed and available for people to use on a local site more.
Are you treating the government ploys and these safety-sensitive positions in for post-accident testing differently than you would expect the industry employees who in similar safety-sensitive positions would be treated in terms of the guidelines and so on that you're referring to, and DHHS guidelines and so on, and executive order?
To the extent that I understand, are you talking about existing post-accident testing policies or prospective policies that are prospective in terms of how they will go into effect?
I'm talking about the way it's in operation now, as you've described it.
Okay. Our internal program for testing civilian employees is the pattern on which the industry regulations, which were issued in November of last year and will go into effect in December of this year, are patterned. And so therefore, I believe the decision criteria are very similar. The need to use HHS certified laboratories, the need to follow those procedures, et cetera, are, to the extent that I know the details of each one of the modal administration's regulations, similar.
Well, let's do some comparison of those, because that's what I'd really like to look at here, because it seems to me, in one sense, the sampling of individuals in this particular accident done on the Exxon Valdez included blood and urine, blood which is required to determine whether impairment has contributed to a probable cause or contributed to an accident. And in this case, we're talking, and for the federal employees, we're talking about strictly urine measurements, are we not? And the present regulation under which the industry is covered in the marine industry is requesting, I think, as I understand it, blood. Is that correct?
I am not familiar with the existing regulation under which Coast Guard is, or the industry is, I'm not familiar with the existing regulation for the maritime industry. I am acquainted with, but not articulate on, the industry regulation that will go into effect in December of this year, 1989. I'm not familiar with the current existing regulation. Uh-huh. And I would defer to Coast Guard and Coast Guard witnesses who can explain that regulation, how it is. But
well, let me go through a couple of the areas here that seem to me quite relevant. You do not, in the present program, employ federal employee, DOT employee, civilian testing program, you do not include alcohol measurements, correct?
That is correct.
You would include only the five drug classes according to DHHS guidelines, correct?
That is correct.
And you would not, you would require only urine, correct?
That is correct.
And in this particular accident, we have blood and urine on the civilian sector, the private sector, and only urine in the federal employees, correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
So how would you, DOT, determine an individual is impaired or as in post-accident testing from a urine measurement, and taken something like 90 hours or 90 plus hours after the incident?
Once again, the purpose of our internal post-accident testing program is not to determine impairment. Our post-accident testing program is not done as part of an examination of the cause of an accident. It is done as part of a comprehensive program in which we are one of the government leaders of prohibiting the use of illegal substances. And the use of illegal substances is deterred in many aspects. One of those aspects, we believe, is if one has an aggressive random program. But we also believe that a post-accident policy, the knowledge by our employees that there could be a triggering event in which would trigger a test, can also serve as a deterrent. So we have one, if I can complete this, we have one objective of deterrence. The second objective is to, as we assess the employee's performance at or about the time of the accident, for simple employer-employee relationship, i.e., do I need to take disciplinary action against an employee? I need to look at how they performed. One of the issues surrounding that is, do we have knowledge of their using illegal substances at any time? So the testing that we're doing is not the same as the testing that I believe you have the results of that were conducted at ChemWest. They're not intended to show impairment. They are intended to show illegal use.
Well, let's take this example of the long delay in getting the specimens on a post-accident investigation. How would you know an individual had used an illicit drug of the five classes, including now for the moment ethanol, if it's a short-acting drug or has a short lifetime in the body and will not show up in the urine after, say, 90 hours? How would you determine that individual had used a drug?
You're saying had used a drug at the time of the accident. I'm assuming that that's what you mean.
If he had used a drug before the accident, for example.
Before the accident. Rather than afterwards.
But the delay in getting the specimen was some, according to this protocol, maybe as long as 2.5 to 3 days.
Now, I would point out that this collection was not in accordance with our protocol. I would point out that this collection didn't fit our guidelines, that there were circumstances that delayed the collector from getting there. There were circumstances that confused the operating administration. The average collection under our post-accident policy has been within 13 hours of the test, of the accident. That may not satisfy the board in terms of responsiveness, but that includes an assessment in automobile accidents. For instance, if one of our truck drivers is in an automobile accident, we need to assess, and there's no injury, bodily injury, we need to assess the extent of the damage to determine whether, in fact, it qualifies. This particular collection, was way outside of our guidelines.
Well, is this the first one you've ever had in the marine industry?
These were the first two tests conducted under our post-accident policy in the U.S. Coast Guard, yes.
So are you suggesting that most accidents are going to happen close to a facility like Upjohn Medical?
I would never make that assumption. I think I stated earlier that we are working with the Coast Guard and the Federal Aviation Administration to figure out a way to speed up the collection process. We are, however, working under an executive order which says we must follow certain procedures. Those procedures include OPM guidance that if we do post-accident testing, we must use the HHS guidelines. If we do post-accident testing using the HHS guidelines, I must use the collection bottles, the collection procedures, and the chain of custody described in those HHS guidelines. I therefore must have either locally or, in the case of the way we try to administer the program, representatives of Upjohn closer to, or people in the Coast Guard or the FAA or someplace else in the department, closer to and available to do collections. And we acknowledge that.
Have you ever sought authority to get other, to use other methods rather than these guidelines you've referred to in the executive order to get other specimens and or to do it differently so you can do it in a more expeditious way?
To the extent that I know, no, we have not sought for either other specimens or for other collection procedures. We've sought for a waiver of the drug limitation. In other words, we have asked, and we are working with the Department of Health and Human Services, to get extended the range of drugs for which we can test.
Would that include alcohol?
That would not include alcohol, because once again, these procedures are developed under the authority of an executive order which speaks only to illegal substances.
Are you in the process of modifying this program to address the other issues that we talked about in terms of the time of collection and the drugs and so on? And what's the state of that modification?
We are constantly trying to improve our performance under these guidelines. As I stated, we're working with the Coast Guard and the FAA to improve the collection time in a post-accident process. We are trying to assure ourselves that if we identify medically qualified and trained individuals out in the field to make the collections, i.e. if I use the regional flight surgeon from the FAA out of Seattle to make collections in the Northwest region, or if there's a medical person from the Coast Guard that we can use to make those collections, that we can train them correctly and supply them correctly with the appropriate collection utensils. In terms of other changes to the program itself, we're assessing within the next several weeks and or months the impact of our total program, including the random testing program, to see what sort of changes we might want to make. And I think I mentioned that we have approached the Department of Health and Human Services with a specific request to expand the number of drugs that we are allowed to test in certain circumstances, including post-accident testing. And both former Secretary Burnley and current Secretary Skinner have challenged us to develop staff-level discussion of our authority to test civil servants under civil service regulations for alcohol. We are uncertain of that authority at this stage of the game.
Okay, we were comparing the regulation, that present regulation on for Department of Interior or Department of Transportation employees versus the private sector. And it's my understanding, based on Exhibit 10B is in Bravo, page 20, that alcohol is included.
Dr. Berkey?
Yes.
Wait, 1 minute, please. Do you have that?
I don't have.
Okay. Ten Bravo.
Just a moment.
We've been listening to testimony from Melissa Allen from the Department of Transportation, dealing primarily with the Department of Transportation drug testing guidelines.
16.240.
Excuse me, I just ended up with the first five pages.
Page 20?
Yes.
Page 20?
Page 20. That's it.
And what is the section reference again, please?
16.240. According to that statement, if I read that correctly, do you have that?
Yes, I have it in front of me.
I think that includes drugs and alcohol post-accident testing for the private sector. Is that correct?
That is the way it reads. Once again, I would defer to the Coast Guard as to where this... I don't understand the reference of 46 CFR 4 something, rather, 06.
Well, we were talking about the comparison, and you thought that the... I heard you say that, I think, in the DOT program, it was going to be, and the new, this is a regulation that's going to in effect in December 21, 1989 for the private marine sector.
It's my understanding that this particular section, and I would defer to the Coast Guard again, but I believe this particular section is based on an existing Coast Guard regulation issued in 1987, I believe, and I don't know the date in 1987, but it is an existing and has been in existence for longer than, this is just an incorporation of an existing program.
Yeah, I think you're referring to the existing regulation, which is 1987, which involves blood testing for individuals in the private sector that with the two requirements of 0.04 alcohol in the blood and or 4-hour waiting period after drinking alcoholic beverage. But the point I was questioning there, whether or not the DOT regulation for DOT employees is going to be indeed the same and treated the same as in the private sector.
I cannot make that judgment because, as I said, we are exploring whether we have the authority over under civil service regulations and civil service laws, and I'm not a lawyer, so I can't give you a civil service cite, but I think it's 5 USC something or other, whether we have the authority to test for alcohol.
I have no further questions at this time.
Thank you, Dr. Berkey. Captain Deppe. Ms. Allen, does the Department of Transportation have any programs to deal with alcohol problems with their employees?
Yes, sir, we certainly do. They've been in existence for 4 years. They're not peculiar to the Department of Transportation dealing with our civil service employees. We've had extensive employee assistance programs. We have programs which allow, and we train our supervisors, our first line supervisors, immediate supervisors, how to deal with performance on the job which appears to be affected by the by abuse of alcohol. I'll say that. We prohibit alcohol on the job. That's throughout the federal government. You can't drink while you're on the job. And there certainly are performance requirements. I must be able to perform my job. We've been supported in our own internal, i.e. Merits of Systems Protection Board decisions that our supervisors taking action to remove an individual because from their safety sensitive duties and send them home or send them to the employee assistance program or just get them out of the office can be done based on observation of performance, slurring of speech, and other observable patterns. And those same actions have been, as I understand it, supported in the U.S. courts.
Is there any discipline that goes hand in hand with the counseling and the EHAB programs?
To the extent that we are allowed to discipline an employee because of their performance, we can do that, yes, sir. I do not personally know the limits to which we can go with that discipline.
If a person's performance remains relatively high, even though they have an alcohol problem, then there would be no discipline for them?
Not necessarily, but we're constrained by a Rehabilitation Act, which requires, I'm not a lawyer, requires once again that we offer rehabilitation to people with an alcoholic who can evidence alcoholic dependency.
If someone does go through a rehabilitation program, are they put back in the sensitive jobs that they previously held?
Upon completion of that program and some assessment, depending on the mode, we're talking alcohol here,
yes.
Are we? They will be put back on those that particular position, and they may be required to sign an abstinence agreement. They may be required to sign a I will go to Alcoholics Anonymous once a week agreement. And if they ever fall outside of the constraints of that agreement, we take disciplinary action.
Would there be a follow-up program, a testing program, or any type of monitoring program that they were following through on their commitment?
There's a monitoring program, but not a testing program. The monitoring program, depending on what the requirement is, but if an employee, for example, must go to Alcoholics Anonymous once a week, the supervisor is authorized to check with AA as to whether the employee has in fact shown up. Certainly if there's any performance or evidence on the job or anecdotal evidence that can be supported by others and proven that an individual has returned to alcohol abuse or use, depending on the severity of the issue, that we can take disciplinary action.
Just one more. Who makes the decision on whether they go to Alcoholics Anonymous or they go to some other type of follow-up program after they're finished with rehabilitation?
For the most part in the civilian sector, we as a department depend on professional employee assistance programs. I'm not familiar with what program exists here in Alaska, but for example, in Washington, D.C., we go to a local general hospital, which is known as an excellent rehabilitation hospital. They do the assessment. They make the recommendation. They make the recommendation, which is then given to our internal professional employee assistance people, who then, with a supervisor, make a decision that the individual is able to come back to the job.
But that person's supervisor would be aware of all this that's taking place, or would it be kept confidential?
The details of the rehab program, et cetera, are very confidential. The fact that the employee has been, I'm assuming that the employee has been sent to the rehab program or the employee assistance by the supervisor, not self-referred.
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah. If the employee has been sent by the supervisor and removed from his or her safety-sensitive duties or his or her duties, the supervisor knows that the employee is undergoing an employee assistance counseling of some sort. They don't know the details of it. But when the recommendation comes back from the professionals to our internal employee assistance program and to the supervisor, he will know that those professionals feel that the individual is ready to come back to the job.
If a person wasn't recommended by their supervisor but just went voluntarily to one of these programs, then the supervisor would not know that this person had a problem, that he was supposed to be following through with some treatment.
That is correct. To the extent that the individual wishes there to be confidentiality, we're required to keep that information confidential.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Woody, let me finish with the parties. Mr. Shire. Dr. Luresh. Commander Waldron?
No question.
You got your wish, Woody.
Thank you. Ms. Allen, is there any federal government program in existence that provides a means to take a urine or blood sample from persons like air traffic controllers or vessel traffic controllers for accident investigation purposes?
Could you repeat your question again?
Certainly. Is there any federal government program in existence that provides a means to take urine or blood samples from persons like air traffic controllers or vessel traffic controllers for accident investigation purposes?
For such as the NTSB accident investigation purposes?
That would be one example.
Our program, as written, acknowledges that the NTSB can identify a triggering event, and we will provide to the NTSB the results of the HHS tests to the extent that we are allowed to by law. Federal law, specifically a Supplemental Appropriations Act passed in 1987, prohibits us from releasing the results of those tests to anyone. I am not allowed to get them on an individualized basis, i.e. identified with an individual, except if the individual gives written consent, which was referred to earlier today, or under court order. To the extent that the board, for example, wishes to do other collections, i.e. not under our executive order program, but other collections, we will pass on that request to the employee and let the employee decide whether they want to give.
So the bottom line is then that the employee will determine whether the results can be used for accident investigation purposes.
I believe that's, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Palucciello?
Just one question. You mentioned that the program is for DOT employees. I take it you do not regard Coast Guard personnel as DOT employees, since they seem to have a different program.
Are we speaking military employees?
Yes.
There is a separate military procedure, which I'm not familiar with, except for to the extent that there has been a military testing program since 1983. I view them as DOT employees, certainly, but they are not under these. This is simply a civilian testing program.
But apparently there are two levels. One, perhaps I'm stating it incorrectly, but I regard the civilian program as somewhat less intrusive than the military program. Is there a reason why, even though there's a Coast Guard testing program, could a Coast Guard military personnel say, well, I want to be considered under only this program, the civilian program, and not the other? Does he have a choice?
I don't know the details of the military testing program. It's my understanding that they test urine, and that they test urine in the same manner that we test urine, and at the same cutoff levels, because I believe, as Dr. Pete suggested, the DOD cutoff levels, which are the same levels that the Coast Guard uses, are the same levels that show up in the HHS guidelines. To the extent that a military person can say, I want to be under the civilian program, no, there is no way they can do that.
But the military testing did include blood in this case, I believe. No, I withdraw that. I guess I was incorrect. Okay. No more questions.
Any questions?
Yes. Just clarification, Ms. Allen.
Yes.
I believe when Dr. Berkey asked you about the HHS cutoff levels, that was carefully decided after consulting with leaders in the field or scientific leaders in the field, and it was decided that to set these levels, they weren't just an arbitrary setting. And the purpose, of course, is clear. You've said it again and again, and that is to provide a drug-free workplace for illicit drugs. Did the only thing that I've have a problem with is, and in simplistic terms, since I'm not a toxicologist, if you only use a little bit of an illicit drug, or if you're tested when your body has sufficient time to detoxify or eliminate it, and you would fall below or very close to the level. Therefore, that was not releasable. In other words, the employee or the employer would be told that he tested negative. And in accident investigation, in our side of the house, we would like to know and would like a very high-tech laboratory to be able to look deeply into the possibilities of the effect backing it up, like we would, like we have tried to do. Was the decision, which I'm not questioning the decision that was made, but was it made for some reasons like false positives and some of all those problems that we've that face the entire industry and nation as far as any kind of drug testing?
The decision to follow the HHS guidelines in terms of post-accident testing, which is what I think you're getting at, as opposed to doing something beyond the HHS guidelines, testing for lower levels, et cetera, was driven by the fact that as we developed our internal program, we were trying to implement the executive order. We were not attempting to develop a program which would respond to the NTSB's need for accident investigation. The guidance, and I'm not a toxicologist either, I'm just learning these terms as we go. The guidance and advice that we got was that one has to be very careful that you don't end up with false positives or positives which can be explained by such things as poppy seed bagels. For example, if one reads the medical review officer guidelines that were issued by HHS, there is an extremely detailed process which a medical review officer must go through to determine that a positive for opiates is in fact a positive for something that is in fact illegal, as opposed to something which is explainable. And so we've erred on the side in following the HHS guidelines of a cautious, what we think is a prudent approach to drug testing in the workplace. And we've adopted those same guidelines for implementation in the industry in the drug testing rules, which are to become effect in this coming December.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ms. Allen, I just have a few questions. Thank you. In Exhibit 11, Bravo, you don't have to refer to it. That's okay.
Okay.
I just want to read the page that Dr. Berkey was reading from, where you talk about the procedures for scheduling urine collection must be begun within the 8 hours.
Yes, sir.
Is by begun, using the example that you just discussed previously, the collector coming from South Carolina, would begun mean when that person gets on an airplane to travel to Anchorage? Is that begun, or does that mean the collection of the specimen is actually begun?
It means that the telephone call to Upjohn Healthcare has been made within those 8 hours, not even the individual climbing on the plane. It is simply the notification by the operating administration to Upjohn that they want the collection to be made.
So therefore, if for some reason it took a week for that individual to get here, it would still, if the call was made within the 8 hours?
No. We then have this additional requirement under a contract, but not under our regulations, that Upjohn get there as soon as possible and within 24 hours.
You did say that, sorry. One other question.
I think you were here, or you may have been here, for Mr. Blandford's testimony. And we talked a little bit earlier about he was tested on March 24th, along with several crew members from the Exxon Valdez. He did give a urine sample, and the results were turned over to the safety board, and they're an exhibit. Now, I think you said that a decision was made that the test was not conducted under DOT guidelines. Let me ask you a question. If you had made a decision, or if the DOT had made a determination that they were conducted under DOT guidelines, then the confidentiality rule or would have taken precedent, and we would not have obtained those results without Mr. Blandford's written consent?
That would be correct. But in addition, if the collection had been made under DOT guidelines, the sample would not have gone to Chem West, the sample would have gone to CompuChem, the other branch, and only been tested for the five drugs, which in fact his later sample was.
Right, because there is no alcohol testing under this.
That is correct.
We have some work to do, don't we?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Terry.
I have just one more, and this is not intended to amuse, but it probably will. You stated that your man in Upjohn was a very good collector, or was considered to be a good collector. We had in this particular incident or accident, it was fortuitous during the collection of the urine sample from Maureen Jones, the watchstander aboard the Exxon Valdez, that there happened to